the weather. Okay, very nice. See if we can get in some shtucks to Kurtz tonight. Tonight we'll make fun of the fair weather. Where's the LA guy? Make fun of the LA guys today. So, okay. Yehuda, do me a favor. Just Sam, make sure the guys are coming late. Get sheets, okay? Where are the extra sheets? Okay. So, as I mentioned, these parshios are extremely fundamental issues. We saw in Parshas Lech Lecha the difference between Avraham, a man of faith, and in Parshas Vayera, Avraham, a man of bris and commitment. We saw in Parshas Vayera, Avraham consulting with his Goyisha friends about bris milah, because he was worried that his Jewish identity would impede his ability to change the world. And last week in Parshas Chayesar, we discussed the shift from Avraham, the dramatic, international, celestial, metaphysical, to the domestic person who just buries his wife, finds a shidduch for his son. And tonight we're facing a very, very interesting, odd phenomena, very atypical situation. Avraham's career spans three parshios. We talked last week about how those three interact with one another. Lech Lecha, Vayera, Chayesara. Lech Lecha and Vayera, natural tandem. Chayesara is unnatural, but the unnaturalness is what makes it the complementary component to Lech Lecha and Vayera. And Emir Tashem next week will begin the real saga of Yaakov, which is going to dominate the entire conclusion of Sefer Bereishis. Yaakov's story begins in Vayetze, Yaakov, Beersheva, Vayishlach, Vayeshev, Mikes, Vayigash, Vayichi, six parshios. But Yaakov, his children, his intrigue, where he lived, Mitzrayim, Aram Naharayim, the Brachos, the conclusion of Vayichi, Berchus Yaakov. And good old Yitzchak has one long parsha. One single parsha. Parsha's told us. And it seems to be very, very asymmetrical, very uneven. If we were to be edgy about it, almost unfair to Yitzchak. And the truth is, the disparity between the coverage which Yitzchak receives and the coverage the other Avos begins well before his parsha, his truncated narrative, begins and ends so abruptly. Because all the Avos have very iconic names. And their names and their Yemos deeply, deeply reflect their mission, their background, so much so that Avraham and Yaakov, the bookends of Sefer Bereishis, actually undergo name changes. Avraham becomes Avraham, Yaakov becomes Yisrael, and each name change carries a message. Avraham becomes the Avhamon Goyim, Avraham. Yaakov becomes Yisrael. He battles with men and angels and survives, and it's the triumph of the Jewish people. Not only does Yitzchak not undergo name change, which itself is a glaring, glaring difference in Sefer Bereishis. Even Yosef has multiple names. There's no name change. But even his name has nothing to do with his personality or his career. Avram's name was punctuated by his mission, Avram on Goyim, Avram, Avraham. Yaakov's name characterized the struggle of grasping the heels of Esav, trying to reorient, re-engineer history so that he'd be the Bechor, and then not just holding on to the heels of Esav, but trying to, as we read about in this week's Parsha, trying to circumvent the Brachos by Akveni Zepamayim. So clearly Yaakov's name speaks volumes about his life's narrative. Yitzchak's name has nothing to do with him. It has to do with everyone awaiting his birth. Why was Yitzchak referred to Yitzchak? Kol HaShomea Yitzchakli. Everyone was laughing. They were laughing when Yitzchak was, when the information was delivered. They were laughing. Can you imagine if your name would be, oh, he's Bozo. Why is he Bozo? We all call him Bozo because we were laughing when we heard the news that my wife is pregnant. Because we're in such a good moon, we call him Laffy Daffy. What about me? What about my name? I've got personality. I've got a future. I've got a career ahead of me. I'm not even getting two names. It's only one name. Can't my one name be mine? Rather than everyone laughing about the news of my imminent birth and the day that I'm weaned from my mother, or they take me and make a party, call Shavuot Yitzchakli. And this trend of the submerging, of the suppression of Yitzchak is well evident. Not before the parsha begins, not only in the name that is given to him because of everyone's response to the news of his birth, but the fact the most dramatic image of Yitzchak, of the entire Sefer Bereishis, of course, is the Akedah. And it is a metaphor for Yitzchak's passivity. Yitzchak's role in the Akedah is to be bound, is to be slaughtered, is to be sacrificed. Of course, there's a cognitive decision, but in terms of drama, he is on the Mizbeach, bound. He's not the author, not the actor. He's being bound up. And Avram is the person who's expressing and displaying and generating the courage, the vision, the movement, the travel, the announcement, the decisions. So even before we read one single pasuk of Parshas Toldos, right off the bat, here's a person who only has one Parsha. Here's a person whose most dramatic moment is when he's bound up and tied. Here's a person whose name is barely his own. Here's a person who doesn't even find his own shidduch. Doesn't even choose his own wife. And choosing wives is clearly part of the central personality, growth, process, narrative of Avram and struggle between his wives. And Yaakov, for sure, much of his life is characterized by that decision. Yitzchak is completely passive in that decision in a very, very evident fashion, in a very prominent fashion in Parshas Chayitzar. So even before we begin reading Parshas Toldos, we sense that there's a trend happening. And then we begin reading the Parsha. And the first thing we read about, Pasuk number Aleph, source Aleph, Ela Toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham. Okay, you can see, imagine Yitzchak saying, here's my Parsha, rolling his sleeves up. I only got one, but it's going to be a doozy. I'm going to pick up in my one Parsha for everything that I missed, not having as many as my father and my son. Ela Toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, what was Yitzchak's real accomplishment? Avraham Holiness Yitzchak, my father's son. Oh my goodness, not again. This is my one parsha. What about me? What about my feats? What about my strengths? What about my talents? That's the first way. Can you imagine a man of Israel? You live a great long life. You accomplish many great things. You change the world. You solve cancer. You're one of the Avos. And on your tomb, they get engraved. What was his accomplishment? He was his father's son. You know, hold the press. What did I do? What about my feats? What about my achievements? So all of a sudden, this trend. What was Yitzchak's great accomplishment? Avram Holiness Yitzchak. And we read the Parsha, the one Parsha that Yitzchak has, which is prefaced by the statement that he's Avram's son. And you sense a very, very pedestrian, boring, banal, venal, very, very quiet. There's no malachim. It's the only Parsha without any malachim. Avram is constantly meeting malachim, speaking to malachim, hosting malachim. Yaakov for sure. Ladders, malachim, shamayim, no malachim, no malachim, no kings. There is one malach, we'll see, but no travels, you know, frequent flyer. It's not like Avram constantly ferrying back and forth. Yaakov constantly ferrying back and forth around the Ryan. All the drama is very subdued, very quiet pasuk, very quiet parsha. Most of the parsha, again, remember the Akedah, I said Yitzchak is passive? Well, if it's passive in the Akedah, he's, so to speak, less than passive in Parshas Toldos. Because all the action is happening, not just around him, but through him. Everyone is maneuvering and manipulating him. Whether it's the food that's being cooked for him, that's being then bartered for the Bechorah, or the Bracha, which he is supposedly supposed to deliver, but isn't, because everyone is engineering and manipulating the Brachas. So if you thought that Yitzchak was passive in the Akedah, wait till you read his one Parsha, Parshas Toldos, where there's very little drama, and the only drama is drama that he isn't authoring, he isn't compelling or directing. And then you finally get to the one section in Perek Chavav. This is the one area that Yitzchak's involved in some confrontation. There's a king here. There's a fight over Eretz Yisrael. There's a Rav. There's a famine. So these are things you'd expect Yitzchak's true colors to come shining through, because this is Yitzchak's moment to shine. Before him is Avram's son, Hara Maria. Afterwards, he's the victim of everyone's manipulation. So let's read. Parak Chavav, Soros Gimel. Vayhi Rav Ba'aretz. There's a famine. So Yitzchak is ready to show his colors, to show his grits. Milvad HaRav HaRishon Asher HaYab Avram. This is part two of Avraham's famine. Can I even have my own famine? Can I even have a famine? Can it be my famine? Vayhi Rav Ba'aretz, Soros Gimel, Milvad HaRav HaRishon Asher Haya B'Meh. I want a famine. Can it be my famine? Let's be part two of Avraham's famine. Why can it be my famine? I want a famine. I want to have that little struggle. So Yitzchak travels. Where do you think he travels? To the same place that Avram traveled. And he comes up with this really interesting idea. Okay? It's in the middle section in Gimel, right before Dalet. So the people ask, who's that woman? And he creates a really interesting cover story. Where have I heard this one before? Someone telling Avimelech, oh, that woman, she's attractive, she's my sister. So the famine is the famine of Avram. The king is the same king that Yitzchak travels to. And the ruse, the cover story, exact same cover story. And listen to what Hashem tells him to stay, because obviously he didn't travel to Mitzrayim, the other creative place he would have traveled to. Hashem tells him, stay in Eretz Yisrael. So this is Yitzchak's only apparition, only revelation. Okay, this is the only struggle, the only rub, the only promise. So let's read Pasuk Gimel, Gur Baretz Hazos, Vavarachacha, Vayemcha, Vavarachacha, stay in this land, Kilachal Zaracha, Tenez Kalitz Hazael, Verabasi Zaracha, Kechachve Hashemayim, and Asati Zaracha, Pasuk Dalet. So here Yitzchak must be, finally, it's not my famine. I don't really have much of a choice. I can't leave Eretz Yisrael. No angels await me, no kings. But at least Hashem's giving me a bracha. At least Hashem's coming and telling me I'm the one. He's selecting me. He's giving me a compliment. This is good to be Yitzchak. So what does Hashem tell Yitzchak? Why am I giving you a bracha? Look at Pasuk Hey. Ekev asher shama Avraham bekoli. Because Avraham was such a good guy, Yitzchak. You know, chopped liver. But Avraham, he was my trusted servant. And he followed my mitzvahs. So you're going to cash in. You're right. You're Avram's son. Can I get a bracha here? I can't get a famine. I can't get a cover story. I can't get a parsha. I can't get a name. I can't get a melech. I can't get a malach. Please give me a bracha. Nope. It's Avram's bracha. Vayera lev Hashem balayla, who he comes back to him at the end of the section. Anochi elokei Avram avicha. Al tira ki itcha anochi. This is after the whole interaction with Avimelech. Source Gimel Pasuk. Look at the underline. Can't you say something nice about me, HaKadosh Baruch? Can't you say that I'm your Eved? I teach my family also. I'm Avram's son. He follows your mitzvahs. I'm cashing in. You're Lokei Avram Avicha. You're going to do right by me. Bavur Avram Avdi. Please. Just give me a little. I mean, I only have one parsha. 80% of the parsha isn't even mine. Everyone's working around me. This is my only moment. This is my only moment to shine. At least give me a little love. Give me a little press. And now let's read that one little time that Hashem isn't speaking to Yitzchak. And he has that little struggle. So it's not like Hashem is going to announce himself as a Kerem Avicha. So Yitzchak has to struggle with Avimelech about the wells. Source Dalet. Vayeshev Yitzchak vayachbar es beres hamayim asher chafru Avraham Aviv. He goes back and he digs the same wells. Okay, obviously you think, okay, it makes sense for him to dig the same wells because it's easier than digging new wells. But now he has to call the wells names. And okay, so at least you can call the name. Call it Yitzchak's well, water well, water Yitzchak, Yitzchak water, Be'er Lachai Yitzchak. And naming is a very iconic moment. You name things after yourself, after your wife, after your children, after your goals. Names carry importance. So what does Yitzchak call it? Vayikra lehem shemos, the end of source Dalet. Kashemos Hashem Karalem up. If he just renames those same wells. So obviously it's not just HaKadosh Baruch Hu preventing Yitzchak from shining, but Yitzchak also makes that conscious decision of making it intentionally colorful and humorous just to highlight the point. As Chazal say, look at the final source of Avraham Nikra Avraham, Yitzchak Nikra Avraham. Avram was called Avram, and everyone called Yitzchak Avram. And Chazal say, look, just like Avram, the Chsev, Ve'ele told us Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avram. Avram, Avram. So what's up here, guys? I just made it intentionally humorous, just so you should sense the trend in Chazal, in the Psukim, in the narrative, in the words. Where is Yitzchak? Where is Yitzchak? And the answer is as follows, and this is really the fundamental point tonight. Every revolution is only successful if it's followed by a period of stability that tries to entrench the revolutionary ideas. Human experience is a cycle between shifting paradigms and entrenching those new shifts, those new paradigms. If life is always revolutionary, always change, always new ideas, new values, new systems, new, then it just constantly saps the energy. So it's like a fire, that oxygen, it just dies. Fire needs oxygen to live. Ideas need periods of entrenchment where they are lived quietly but deeply. You become part of the norm, part of the paradigm. People understand them. People take root in them. Take, for example, the French Revolution. French Revolution was a revolution which wasn't succeeded by a period of stability. And today's revolutionaries became tomorrow's victims. Robespierre was later murdered by the same mobs that he had led. Jean-Paul Marat was later murdered by the same mobs that he helped foment. Because there's no period of stability, and to a degree, and there are little props to the Americans, to a degree that's what makes the American Revolution so fascinating. That rebels turn into statesmen. People will spend their time fighting off, any Brits here? No, Naftalis in here, okay. Fighting off the British persecution, then turned around and drafted a constitution, and drafted states and laws and stability. And the ideas of the revolution, which were new ideas, we take them for granted because they've become accepted values in the human consciousness. These ideas were not established. They were not understood. They were not lived. And all of a sudden, it had to just be lived. Not all of a sudden. Then there were later periods and later spirals of revolution. But these ideas had to take hold. People had to understand what democracy was, what freedom was, what liberty was, what right for land was. These were new concepts. These were new paradigms. Every transition requires subsequent periods of stability to lock in those new paradigms. Even in Torah, there's a fascinating introduction of the Netziv to the Shildos, in which the Netziv says that Torah has been studied cyclically from the moment it was given. And those cycles contain tandem components, periods of great creativity, new development, new ideas, new horizons, new thinking, followed by periods of just assembling information, organizing information, collecting information. We take a look, for example, the period of the Tanoim and the Amoraim. Brand new, fresh ideas, fresh ways of thinking, or at least of articulating thoughts. And that was followed, if let's say the period of the Tanoim and the Amoraim end about the year 400, that was followed by about 600 years of the Gaonim. The Gaonim were not great Chachanim. The Gaonim didn't try to reinvent the wheel. The Gaonim did legwork. What was the exact language of the Tanaim, collecting the Tanaim's ideas, deciphering them, poskening, concluding which Tana was more authoritative. Then all of a sudden, the year 1000, I'm rounding off figures, launched the period of the Rishonim. New thoughts, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Rabbeinu Tam, the Ravid. And that 500-year period was succeeded by the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch in 1559 launched a whole new period. Now we don't have to be Mechadesh, we just have to collect all those Chidushim, organize them, filter them, rule conclusively which are authoritative, which aren't. Do you know the most important Sefer on Shas written in the 17th century? I don't even own it. I may own it somewhere in my bookshelves. I've never used it. The most important Sefer on Shas written in the 17th century was a Sefer called Ki Kayon Diona. Hmm. Have you ever heard it quoted? And no one uses it. Here and there. Woe the great Svarim written in the 17th century. Shach, Taz, Magen Avraham. All the Svarim written on Shulchan Aruch. Because people said, okay, we have to shift gears. Now many of these Svarim actually explain Gemaras, but the focal point, the point of origin is Shulchan Aruch. Okay, what is Shulchan Aruch? Let's collect, let's gather, let's process. Then all of a sudden, 18th century, a whole new period of creativity, of innovation itself, the Nesivos. The great Achronuch himself with Pnei Ashur B'Kiv Eger, and then, so to speak, the end point, the Gra, the Chaim V'Lajin, V'Lajin Yeshiva, and then the end point of that whole thing, of Chaim actually taking so much of this intellectual ferment and building categories and building ideas. And now one could claim that we're in a period of assembling and collecting and gathering. What are the most important Svarim written over the last 100, 150 years? Kahati, making the Mishnayos available to people. Art scroll, Shatnasin, whatever, all the Gemaras, and make Gemara available to people that can't plow through the difficult labyrinth style of Gemara. Bar Ilan, you know, the digitizing of information. Mishneh Berurah, which basically is just an anthology of ideas. Mishneh Berurah was never written to be a posek. Mishneh Berurah just took all the Svarim written since the Shulchan Aruch and tried to make them, basically it was an art scroll. Never intending it to be a posek, but what happens is facility yields authority, because whatever's easiest to read, most people read. Most people read it, and most people follow it. And he's a great posek. It's not like he's idiosyncratic. If he's a posek, his ideas are off, then Chafetz Chaim was a clear thinker, clear writer, wrote an incredible sefer. So what's Paschalim? He's got a Lador. Paschalim. But Avraham would always tell us, in his day, It wasn't obvious to pasuk like the Mishnah Berurah. Today, many, many people on road, if you don't have a posek around, you pasuk like the Mishnah Berurah. If you through Moshe Feinstein, Moshe Feinstein disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch left and right. Left and right. He's a Moshe Feinstein. I mean, you can disagree with the Mishnah Berurah. And most people, when they ask me what I should pasuk like, I say the Mishnah Berurah should be your baseline. Obviously, you could ask your Rebbe. In this place, we hold like the Mishnah Berurah. We don't hold like the Mishnah Berurah. That's a great baseline, but it's never like, ah, you hold differently from the Mishnah Berurah, you know. Some people always, in environments in which boys and people don't wear hats for davening. What do you mean? It says in the Mishnah Berurah, you have to wear a hat during davening. So aside from the adjustment of when the Mishnah Berurah wrote to current day, where hats have totally changed their social positioning, their social influence, but even in the days of Mishnah Berurah, when you say, okay, that's Mishnah Berurah's psak, you have to wear a hat during davening, people have different positions, along with many, 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 many other halachas. So every situation of revolution has to be followed by a period of stabilization, of consolidation, of entrenchment. And it's tougher, it's more difficult. It's easy to be revolutionary. There's a freshness, there's a newness, discovery. I want to do new things, I want to explore. It's adventurous, it's exciting, it's enthusiastic. You feel yourself bristling with energy, new gusts, new ideas, new people, new places. But if you don't have the ability in life, at grander levels and in personal levels, not just in the grand issues such as politics, Lahavdil, and Torah, obviously, but also in your own lives, to just live life and take ideas and live them deeply and entrench them in your consciousness and in the people around you, it's all going to be very shallow, very fleeting, very fading. And that's really the strength of Yitzchak. Yitzchak's midah is the midah of Gevura. He doesn't have to shine. He doesn't need his name in bright lights. He doesn't need multiple parshias. He doesn't require drama. He doesn't require action. He doesn't require malachim. He doesn't require malachim. He doesn't require new famines, new wells, new names, new cover stories, new places to travel. Doesn't require, that's precisely the point. What did Yitzchak do? The answer is nothing other than take Abraham's great and bold new ideas, which we take for granted and make them for granted and make them cliché. Things become cliché because they are lived consistently, repetitively, continuously, generation after generation. And that's really the message of Yitzchak. Abraham will lead us Yitzchak. He was just Avraham's son. And again, we take it for granted. Monotheism and morality and belief in one God and belief in an invisible God. These were not obvious. These were not gimmies. People worshipping planets. People, morality was not a gimme. People were sacrificing human beings. The message of the Akedah Hashem doesn't want you. These were not simple ideas. And it just required Yitzchak to live his life, to entrench them. And Yitzchak's the first farmer. That's one thing he does. It's very quiet in the parasha, but he has a farm. And a farm means you just live on the same land year in, year out, as opposed to a shepherd or a herder. We have to move from mountain to mountain. Once the vegetation, the foliage has been exhausted on that mountain. And it has ramifications, not just for stability, but it has ramifications for Eretz Yisrael. So it's the first person to actually be Kona something more than a plot of land to bury his wife in Eretz Yisrael. It has national ramifications as well as just religious and metaphysical ramifications. He doesn't traps from place to place, from place to place. He's just able to sit in one place. And that's the sort of I'm looking for. That's the modulation that you have to really, really be careful about in life. And you always have to modulate between the two. In the macro and in the micro. Even in the micro of this year, I want to talk to you about how to succeed in this year. I want to talk to you about life. Even in the micro of this year, there's so many things you could fill your year with, and so many opportunities and programs and organizations. And to a degree, high school really was very similar to that. New triggers, new stimulants, new when's the next game, when's the next mock trial, when's the next debate, when's the next hockey game, when's the next. And you're so busy leaping from excitement to excitement that are you able to fill the intervening moments with meaning and depth. And much of high school, that's really one of the shifts of yeshiva, especially yeshiva like this, is to go from being a diffuser to a concentrator in many, many ways. Not just one topic and one goal, but also one room. Basically, it's not too early to just accentuate for everyone here that began the year, those who began the year in Elul, that more or less success in this yeshiva the first shell, because success is never just academic, because it has to be existential. The real success is, it's changing me. The real success is, what does this all mean to me? The real success is, what is it going to change my life into? But at least the first shell, the first layer of success is, how many hours are you in that room? Basically, that's what it takes to be successful. And even if you're not learning every hour in that room, a lot of people still have a hard time committing all those hours, and the room becomes a scary place to be. My recommendation is, and listen carefully, it's going to sound a bit heretical. Use that room partially as the room of batala, partially as the room of limbo. There's nothing wrong with being in the base matters talking, nothing wrong with being in the base matters resting, nothing wrong with being in the base matters thinking, looking at the ceiling. If you're in your room, you're out of bounds. You're not part of the rhythm of yeshiva. If you're in the base matters, you're in it. You're part of the rhythm. You're feeding off of the energy. You're ricocheting off of other people. You're hearing people discuss ideas. I know it's loud. I know it's hard to focus. But trust me, you won't have a room like this for the rest of your life. It kills me. It kills me when people take large blocks of time in the library. That is such... You're cheating yourself. You're cheating yourself. You're going to have quiet libraries, quiet rooms, the rest of your life. But this infectious, contagious energy that part energizes you and part guilts you. Okay, you're not in the mood to learn. You come into the basement, all of a sudden the guy next to you is screaming at the top of his lungs, and it's like, okay, it's hard to focus, but you're guilted into it. Okay, he's doing it, I'm going to do it. You get with the flow. You're not going to have that. You're never going to have this. So to walk away from that room, you're defrauding yourself. You're preventing yourself out of these opportunities. So at this point, the concentration geographically, just to spend 12, 13, 14 hours a day in that room, even if only 8, 9 of them are real learning, but just being there for so many hours will rub off on you and will integrate you into the culture and will make you feel like this is something I'm part of. I know it's very difficult, but be what I call be a base matters bum. That's part of the growth spurt. Even if you're not ready to learn every single minute in the base matters, be a base matters bum. Don't walk out of that place. It's hard because you're not used to being in one room your whole day. You're not used to learning more or less one topic. If not for one day, for 5 hours, for 6 hours, for 3 hours at night. But that's how things are really accomplished. Real excellence in life is the product of massive and focused achievement, not diffused energy. You hone in on something, you divest from other pursuits, and you stop diffusing energy, but you focus your energy on a particular goal. You repeat with small acts, with multiple U's, fells the highest tree, Shakespeare. Small acts, many years, falls on ice trees. You chop, and you chop, and you chop, and you chop. And that's the recipe for success in life. And so many people have a hard time doing that. That the call of newness, of new ideas, of new pursuits, is always, it's always like snipping at them. It's always grabbing them. And there's wasted energy and wasted, and we've talked about this a lot, there's wasted. That's the Gevur of Yitzchak Avinu. He doesn't need to be new. And obviously in the macro sense. In the macro sense, obviously, these are years of new ideas for you. As much as you're focusing your energy in yeshiva, this is a new experience. The next couple of years are basically characterized. Most people settle into their identity. Hopefully, you'll settle into your identity by the age of 25, 27. Obviously, things change and there are adjustments. But some people just never reach that. So much of life is finding out who you are and being that person and digging your heels in and just being firmly committed to those values. So many people take so long to find that you. And it's sad just to find so much wasted resources and wasted energy, and especially today, where so much of identity is obviously who you marry and family and where you're going to live, and this pointless delay, because obviously family carries responsibility and obligations and financial responsibilities, and just a pointless delay. So you really, as much as you think you're you, because modernity has created a facade, you have enough money to live in your own apartment, with your own salary, with your own car, with your own set of friends, with your own gym membership, but that's not really the full you. The full you, certainly for us, is the person you marry, the family, and the community you're helping build. And the longer that's delayed, so that there's a trade-off, of course. Once you enter into those situations of commitment, you'll have less money available, and less time on your hands, and less freedom, but deeper identity, more persona, more depth. So we're at a real crisis point, and a lot of the Rebbeim here, myself included, are strong proponents of people getting married earlier. Even, listen carefully, I'd rather people get married too early than too late. Sometimes you go to people, Rahmana's parents of a girl, let's say, and it's always harder for women to get married. Going to a parent of a girl who's is in a very, very advanced stage and isn't married, it's harder to get married because there's a biological component as well. I would tell that person, if you could give me $100,000 today, and I would guarantee that your daughter would find a beautiful, beautiful chassan, I think 99.9% of parents that could afford that would write the check there on the spot. Are you kidding me? In fact, they do. In certain cases, that's the shakhanis money that people take or something equivalent. So instead of that, what about letting your children get married before they finish their 13th degree and they're a doctor, lawyer, and PhD candidate? In the sense, we can't get married until you have those 3 degrees in your pocket and you're an Eretz Yisrael to a degree, as you witness to some of your friends, because it's so far off and so remote, because everyone's doing army and everyone's staying in yeshiva 5-6 years, and even secular Jews delaying it 3-4 years, the army and post-army. Everyone basically says, okay, we're not going to wait until we have a 10th degree to get married. We'll get married, we'll struggle, we'll put it together. And I'm talking in personal, my daughter just got engaged, as you know, she's in her 3rd year after high school. Chassan is not something I'm just speaking in theory, something I believe very strongly in. And parents have to help. That's part of parental responsibility. No one here is more wealthy than people in America. And there's nothing wrong with parents chipping in as best as they can to get young couples off the ground. So much of identity is delayed until you hit that. And just be careful you don't fall into that trap. Not because, even if I knew that it's not really a trap. Even on a crystal ball and I could tell that, no, don't worry, I'm going to wait till I'm advanced in age, and I'll be so successful, and I'll be so handsome, and I'll be so such a Ben Tire or whatever. I'll be sure to get a proper shidduch. I'm not taking any risk. It's not a question of taking a risk. The question of all those years that you could be building something sturdy and something lasting, you're not building as much as you can. And all those energies are being wasted. That's Yitzchak Avinu. And you have to have that ability in life to modulate. So again, don't get me wrong. I'm a big proponent of change. And I've used that word very often in this room. And I've pressured you as best I can to being open to change and new gust wind. And some people are so locked and rooted into their current self with the security blanket of the past that when new gusts come, they refuse to change. They refuse to reconsider. And I've pushed you so desperately and so urgently to be open to new paradigms and new thoughts. Just last week, we talked about that in Parshas Chayisara. But there are periods in which you just have to live those changes deeply and continuously and repetitively. Because they're not going to be times of excitement and shifts and new adventures. To a degree, I'll use words that are very, very raw. How do you treat boredom? I think modern man has a struggle against boredom. He's afraid to be bored. I think part of it harps back to the great existential crisis of World War I. World War I really changed the human experience because it introduced the new, scary, frightening ideas. We could kill each other in larger volumes, kill each other more brutally than we killed each other in the past. War, which was so romanticized, now became terrifying and horrific. And so many other ways in which the modern world of the 1800s really fell upon people as an avalanche in the early 20th century. And I think people really feel a vacuum of identity. I don't think most modern men have a sense of what do I live for? What am I working towards? What is the purpose of my life? And sometimes we just try to distract ourselves from facing those questions. And if I could just watch movies endlessly and sports endlessly and enjoyment endlessly, then I don't have to really focus on that because I have an opiate. I'm just calming myself and diverting my attention and recreating. And I don't really have to worry about the larger questions. And when the world is all of a sudden very quiet and it's boring and all of a sudden those larger questions peer out, what are you living for and what's important? And what about sacrifice and selflessness and values and nobility and vision and idealism? And those are heavy, heavy challenges. And it's easier just to avoid those challenges entirely. So boredom is not something you should fear. Boredom is something you should embrace, not because you want to be a boring person, because you want to be a person of meaning. And the only way to reach deep meaning is just to do things again and again and again. And this is why yeshiva life is such a good exercise in that. If you can train yourself to come to the Beis Medrash day in, day out, tomorrow's not going to be radically different than today. The next sugya, it's not going to titillate you like a new movie, not going to be a car chase in the Beis Medrash. You know, no one's going to drop in a Batman suit and, chase the Rosh Hashiva around. It's going to be the same boring, cold, rainy day tomorrow that it was today. And you know what the biggest thing on the menu, the big ticket from tomorrow's menu is going to be? Toin v'chozer v'toin. As opposed to migo l'mafreya. That's about as much excitement as tomorrow will bring. And if you're addicted to excitement, it can get very, very boring. But if you train yourself to be addicted to meaning, well, that's how you reach it. And these are religious values as well as general values. The attractive, bright lights, a new lecture, a new organization, and a party, and a, you can spend the next 7-8 years solely chasing new ideas, exciting events, one rock to another, and you walk out, excuse me for saying this, but I'm a little bit older than you, I've been around the block a few times, and I'm being a very, very shallow person. If you want to be a really deep person, so spend your evenings, if you're an Oved Hashem, reading and studying at Kodesh Baruch Hu's Torah primarily. Even if you're not, if I'm talking to Harvard graduates right now, I'd say, stop with the parties and stop with the excitement, stop with the sports, and just sit down and read a book. And read a book, make sure you finish 5 books a week. However you want to read it, in a book, on your iPad, just read books. Yeah, I know they're not exciting, but you'll walk away with deeper meaning. And that's Yitzchak's challenge, and that's strength, it's inner strength. It's the strength, the security. Not to have to fear being in someone's shadow. It's part of what you're looking for now, and this is not just an existential challenge, it's also a religious challenge. You want to find your own identity, because that's what part of growing up is. And sometimes that search and pursuit of personal identity takes a rebellious tone to it. I can't just follow my parents' footsteps, because then I'm just being my father's son. And I want to break free of that shadow. Kafka once said that we have to hate our ancestors to break free of their bondage, of their rule, of their presence. And that's a very, very harsh statement. And Kafka had a very terrible relationship with his father. Anyone who's read The Metamorphosis, you can sense that immediately. Terrible relationship with his father. But there's this inner struggle. Very famous tziv, Ish imovi aviv tirao. Why of all the mitzvahs, mitzvah kibud av v'aim is prefaced by the word ish. Every mitzvah is directed at ish. Ish. Barav tov l'matzos. Ish. L'aftarecha kamocha. Imov aviv tirao. Ish. Imovi aviv tirao. So the tziv says, very psychologically astute, that every person wants to be an ish. Every person wants to be his own man. And that's on a collision course with kibud av v'aim. Because kibud av v'aim means you defer to someone else's authority. You submit to another person's request. Doesn't mean you become them. Kibud av v'aim doesn't mean you have to become your parents. A lot of people confuse this. Kibud av v'aim does not mean the following two things. And I don't say this because I devalue these two pursuits. I say this because some people don't have the ability or even the right to translate kibud av v'aim this way, but it doesn't exonerate you from kibud av v'aim. Kibud av v'aim means you help your parents and you treat them with respect. Talk to them properly, attend to their needs, participate in their lives. It does not necessarily mean you agree with their values and you become like them. Sometimes it can, that would be the ideal. It's not kibud av v'aim, that's just tradition and continuity. And it certainly doesn't mean you love your parents, although ideally you should. Some parents aren't deserving of your love. It doesn't mean you can't be mekayem and kibud av v'aim. A lot of boys get married. Oh, my father is this, my mother is this. Parents who aren't balei tshuva. Parents who aren't firm. Kids who are balei tshuva. You have kibud av v'aim just like the other person. Doesn't mean you agree with their lives and become not firm. Kibud av v'aim. It means you give them food, you help them out. Now, obviously, if you're zochot to have parents, you can intensify and augment the kibud av v'aim by love and by identification, matav u'manayim. But a lot of people don't understand this. So what do you disagree with your father? So why do you disagree with your mother? So what they hurt you? So it doesn't make a difference. Your responsibility to treat them with respect, to talk nicely to them. That's what Siv says. You want to be an ish, sometimes you have to be an ish. You have to be a lach lacha, like Avram. You still have to find a way. You can't keep it ever. Hey, that's what's so hard about religion. You're looking for your own identity, looking for that new sense. And so much of Avodas Hashem, as I've stressed before, is tradition and deliver truths and what we've been doing for thousands of years and accepting those. And how do you find that healthy balance between the two? That's not easy. I'm saying this to you not to scare you, but to give you stamina. Because if you're struggling with it, that's a healthy struggle. You're normal. Don't worry. I have rebellious tendencies. I want to be new. I want to be different. Every 18-year-old male more or less has that. Not every, but most. And then religion says, well, don't go out and carve your own identity. Just receive it from others and live it like others have lived it. And everyone has a different boundary as to where those two stand. But for everyone, it has to be a dynamic between the two. And Yitzchak is reminding us, as fresh and as creative, as inventive as Avram is, and as fresh, as creative, as inventive as Yaakov is, the book ends, Yitzchak's life is really, really boring. Yitzchak's identity is really, really submerged within Avram's, and that's not always a bad thing. It takes a strong person, a secure person. Sometimes it's a good thing. Some of those people that are always protesting and defending their territory, those are the weakest people. Strong people don't really care. don't need it. They're strong. Their strength is in our Kadosh Baruch Hu. What's your strength? Remember this ad that was in the States a couple years ago. What's in your wallet? What's in your wallet? What is it going to take? What's your identity built on? Everything your identity is built on can be taken from you in a moment, in a flash. There's nothing you will build in this earth. And unfortunately, and I say this, chalila b'chas, with no degree, chalila b'chas. You see people who have spent years and years, centuries, decades, building and building, and in a flash, it was ruined, in a flash, and that's just money. Health can be taken from you, life can be taken from you, family can be taken from you, mental health, you say, well, I am myself, and I can lose everything, but that can be taken from you also. A hormone change, all of a sudden, hormone shift, and it's all taken from you. The only thing you have that's yours, that can't be taken from you, is your values and your relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, your effort to live those values. That's the rock of your identity. If you have that rock, then everything else is secondary. More money, less money, people think better of you, less of you. More headlines, less headlines. My name is Yitzchak, my name is Avram. You call me Ray, call me Jay, call me whatever you want. Ma Hashem Salim Sadasi. My davening, my Avodas Hashem, my mitzvahs, no one can take from me. No one can take from me tonight how many mitzvahs I have. It's all mine. Everything else, I'll try my hardest, but you know, there are other people in this world, even my own family, that have minds of their own. Can't really do much. I can try, I can help, but what do I have? That's what Yitzchak has. Yitzchak has that rock solid rootedness. And it's that word rootedness in Avodas Hashem, even when it's just the same minyan day in, day out, the same shul, the same learning, the same mitzvahs, the same Shabbos, the same kol, the same child, the same family, the same wife. Sociologists have discovered a 7.5-year itch. 7.5-year itch. And for those of you who are still struggling with many of these issues of Negia and many of the issues of Yichud and Chazal, seem so hard to keep, and they are hard to keep, and trust me, they're hard to keep, and Mirz Hashem, when you're older, you'll realize the wisdom, and it's just, again, so much of it is just trusting people. I use that word so often. You have to open it. It's not something you're built for. You've been built for distrust, because so much in our world has proven to be other than we thought. Every celebrity, every sports star ends up being a fraud, and a philanderer, and a liar, and a cheat, and a druggie, and so much is just trusting. You know, we don't have any agenda. I'm not getting a commission based on whether you agree with me or disagree with me, because we really want to inspire you like we've been inspired. So there's just the mice that happened over the weekend that broke in America. General Petraeus. Right? General Petraeus, fill me in. He was the chief of staffs in Iraq, or the Afghanistan, general of Afghanistan. And since then he was appointed head of the CIA. And his biographer, a woman, as a female who was a biographer, they ended up conducting an extramarital affair with one another, and the emails were discovered, and he had to basically step down amidst humiliation. He had to step down as a security risk, because it could be used to blackmail him. It's also humiliating. It's known to the public. And I saw this quick little blurb, and I wanted to put it on my Facebook page, but I couldn't share it. I couldn't log in. But basically, the blurb was, you know, the dangers of being in concealed places with the opposite sex, or you know, something like that, who Dorsey's. Basically, this is his biographer. And the biographer was very complimentary to him, and every man likes a good compliment. And they were constantly in close quarters working with one another and sending emails to one another. Yichud! Mamash the Isser of Yichud. This is what Chazal are so insistent about, that a man should not be in close, private quarters with another woman that isn't his wife, because this is exactly what can happen. But Mamash, the title was an English description of Yichud. It was like in some tech blog, the dangers of being in private situations with women who look up to you, something like that. As my daughter was saying, namely Yichud. You want to say the word Isser Yichud. So many of these things are, so sociologists, 7.5-year itch. It's been determined sociologically after 7.5 years, the male loses the excitement of the female-male situation. It's boring. Correct, I mean, the relationship between male and female is not only supposed to be adventurous, it's on the part supposed to be communication. Those will be other things you'll learn about Mirz Hashem one day. And that's why most extramarital affairs take place on average around 7.5 years, called 7.5-year itch. Because all of a sudden, it's no longer exciting, it's no longer adventurous, it's no longer new. Same person, same relationship, same house, same family. And that's the message of Yitzchak. And that's why there's so many moments. It's the same love, it's the same challenge. Take your life, take the values and live them deeply, whether they're the delivered values from your parents and from your rebbes, or even your own values that you now just have to start living. Whatever time, whatever values you'll discover, just live them. So many people don't have that ability. They're looking for the next big thing. They're looking for the next excitement, the next hormone jolt, the next adrenaline rush. And unfortunately, it ends up backfiring. And people will be very, very diffused. It's a continually diffused life. So this is the saga of Yitzhak. I have 8 minutes, so I'll just segue into the selling of the Bechorah. The selling of the Bechorah. I don't know how much of this we'll discuss, but I just want to at least read the Psukim with you. Because the Psukim are so humorous, and everything that's humorous, and I like to make it humorous for you, are very, very clear and transparent. Vayazad Yaakov Nazid, source Aleph, Vayava Menasada Vuayev. So right off the bat, you have someone who's tired. And he's tired because he's a corporate lawyer. He's been at work all day. Work, 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 work. His BlackBerry, calendar, his organizer, full to the brim. 1 to 2, 3 to 3, Vayav Menasada. This is a hard pasuk to read, I have to tell you. It's a hard pasuk to read. Halitainina min hadom hadom hazeh. Fill her up. Eating. And for Esav, eating is like going to a gas station. Fill her up with super unleaded. Again, I shouldn't make a funny joke because so many people in America can't fill up their cars with gas now because there's gas rationing. But the gas stop. Fill her up, Lauer, no smiling. I know the Cleveland guys say you never can. Fill her up. Just teasing. Anyway, fill her up. So much of change in yeshiva, guys. Seriously, Dan, I'm just kidding. Okay. So much of change in yeshiva is not just how much Gemara you learn and how well you daven, how much frumkeit, but it's also a more dignified person, a more classy person. And there are times in our life where we're perilously close to acting like an animal, because a human being is a combination of an animal and an angel. And there are times we act like angels when we think, when we emote, when we share, when we share information, when we act nobly. There are times we are closer to the animal world. When we eat, when we procreate, when we relieve our waste, those are the things that animals do like humans. And it's a time that we're veering precipitously close to the animal world that we have to reaffirm our human dignity. And that's why table manners is so, so important. I'm not telling you should sit like in England with 4 knives and 6 forks and 23 spoons and a bread knife and a butter knife and a... Okay, no English guys. I never know to make fun of. But, okay, but, you know, sit at the table and don't make a mess. And I know sometimes I can't sit. I remember one night, I was in DRS, the Shmuley's High School, till like 10 o'clock at night. Interview. And I drove home to where I was staying in Brooklyn, and it was like 12 o'clock. I hadn't eaten a morsel of food the whole day. And the only place open was a fast food place in Brooklyn called Kosher Delight. So I walked into Kosher Delight, and it was 12:15 at night. I ordered my food. Who do you think was there? I mean, who comes out at 12:15 at night? The goons and the ghouls. So I'm sitting around the table. I ordered my food, and just the table manners were just so despicable. Like people were sitting like this and eating and throwing food. I just took my food, put it into my bag, tossed it into the garbage, and said, my dignity is worth more than my stomach. I'd rather go to bed hungry with my dignity intact than sit there like an animal and just put food in my mouth. Don't ever put food in your mouth like an animal. Doesn't mean you have to sit there with 14 napkins and sit there and make a big deal. But you sit at the table, it should be clean. Respect yourself. Respect the other people at the table. Total opposite of Esav. He runs in from the field, pour it in. It doesn't mean how much you eat. I know when you're young, you like eating. Because you need a lot of food. Boys really like eating. A, because they need it nutritionally. B, because it's just something that's relaxing. Makes you want to. I'm not talking how much you eat. That's something at a later stage when you grow up and you can make sure you don't overeat and stuff like that. But just, at least when you eat, you know, don't run in the street and, okay, you can eat a snack. And then so much of eating has changed. People used to sit around and eat around the table, around the carpet on the floor. Now we're constantly eating on the run. Okay, life changes, life adjusts. There's nothing wrong with eating a chocolate bar in public or drinking some soda or an ice cream. But I would feel uncomfortable walking down the street eating a piece of pizza. And that would be something that is uncouth. That's not reflective of a bentar. I'd have a hard time walking down the street eating a hamburger. That's not reflective of a bentar. You make sure that you sit there and you project. It's not class and it's not this way, just dignity in certain things you don't. Okay, I'm sure there are things on the margin, I don't know, but you know, you're certainly not going to walk around with maybe shawarma's a little dim. But again, it depends upon the context, depends who you are. These are not hard and fast rules, like Harrigan's rule book of, you know, food, what you eat and where. It's just the sense of how you eat, and even sometimes when I'm traveling, I have a very hard time because I normally go to a city and I, you know, conduct the interviews and I take a plane 5-6 at night and I land in the place that I'm going to for the next day later on in the evening, go to sleep and start the next day. So that means that if I don't eat on the plane, you know, I'm not going to have dinner that night. I'm going to get there too late to have dinner. So what I'll do is wherever I am, I'll buy a sandwich, I'll take it on the plane for my 5 o'clock flight, and whatever, 6, 7 o'clock, I'll have the sandwich, and then I'll arrive and that'll be my dinner. So it's uncomfortable, you know, you're sitting on a plane, these are very tight planes, you're going to come in with your meat sandwich, with your onions, and your, you know, it's not necessarily so nice to the person next to you to come up with a piping hot, by that time it's not really piping hot, but, you know, I try to be sensitive, it's not, you know, just throw yourself into the food. As Esav comes in, haliteni nam min hadom hadom, fill her up. It's also, he doesn't even have any taste. It's from that red stuff. The red stuff. How do you talk like that about food, from the red stuff? It's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu's food, and Matzil Lechem Minara. And again, you don't have to romanticize food. It's not like all of a sudden you're going to bow down to the pretzel or bow down to the falafel. But Halitaini Nam in Adam is a part of it is because he's just so busy. And I know we have to stop, so I'll just read the final pasuk. The Yaakov Nasan Liesav. Look at Pasuk Yedala and you'll uncork the secret of why Esav can't appreciate Bechorah. Why he can't appreciate future? Because he's just so busy in the present. The Yaakov Nasan Liesav. Lechem Unizina Dashim. You ready? This is the only time, to my knowledge, in Tanakh, we have 5 straight words. All of them are verbs. Vayochal, Vayesht, Vayakam, Vayelach, Vayivez Esav Esav Bechorah. 5 straight verbs. You know why? Because Esav was a man of action. And sometimes men of action are too busy to be men of depth. And those men of depth see food as red stuff and see food as gasser up. And then, of course, when opportunities like Bechara come, you're too busy to even see into the depth of things, into the life of things, and say, this is important. It's hard, Bechara. There's own shim, as Rashi says, if I mess up, if I violate these terms, but there's glory and there's depth. But if he's so busy, you may just miss opportunities that require a little thought and a little depth and a little resonance. So it's phrased, if it's all red and it's all filler up and it's all ayef ben asada and it's all vayocha vayesh vayakam v'yarech vayivas, and he blows it. Stop here. Of life, I want to move the world. That's what I really like to say.